Thank you, Christy. Where are you going? Just, if we could make this platform just a little bit smaller, then and pack some more things up here, it'd be awesome. Good morning, everybody. We are going to cover a lot of verses today, so a lot of times I like to just talk to you and kind of ease our way into it, but we're going to just dive right in today because we have zero time to accomplish everything I want. Not zero time. That's not true. We got enough time. In fact, I'm just going to relax. Everything's good. Anyway, we're continuing our study of the Gospel of Matthew this morning, and if you'd like to follow along with us, if you'll find your way to Matthew chapter 26, please. If you haven't been here, you don't know what's going on. We've been going through Matthew chapter by chapter, reading the entire gospel story together, digging into it, trying to see how it applies to our lives. Each one of these studies usually should stand on its own, so don't feel like you're too lost in the woods here if you don't know where we've been before. But I will give you a bit of a background. We're at the last stages of Jesus' earthly ministry. We're at the point where the story's quickly coming to its conclusion. Jesus has come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. He's made some powerful enemies who have plotted to kill him. One of his own disciples, Judas, has conspired with his enemies to reveal his location so that they can have him arrested. And then last week we saw how Jesus celebrated the Passover meal. We talked about that a little bit this morning, went over what that was about as we celebrated the communion here today. And you know, what it is that he's promised to us, this whole redemption and new covenant with God and a new world. I mean, it's a wonderful hope and promise that we have in the gospel. That's what the good news contains. It's about redemption. It's about reconciliation with God. It's about a new world that's on its way. And while we know that, even sometimes just even intellectually, there's often a disconnect between the hope that we put our faith in and our actual experiences that we have in real life, in our everyday experiences. There's oftentimes a disconnect between the triumph that we're hoping in and the experiences that we have. Because face it, I mean, the reality is life has a lot of pain. There's a lot of difficulty associated with living in a fallen world, in a broken place like this. I mean, there's job losses or death or disasters or illnesses or loneliness or broken relationships. All sorts of difficult and painful things come along in life. And the reality is that Christians, as followers of Jesus, we are not immune from those difficulties. We're not insulated from those experiences somehow. One of the biggest challenges of the Christian faith is this nagging question of where is God sometimes in our difficulties, in our times of trouble? What's God doing? Why me? Why do I have to go through this? How could God let this happen in my experiences? And, you know, it's easy to tell a sufferer, well, you know, just read the scripture and have faith. But, I mean, sometimes our faith is falling apart because of the troubles that we're going through. And that's not such a comforting answer to someone who's experiencing those things. Do you relate to what I'm talking about at all? I mean, I'm hoping I'm not the only one here that goes through these things. But the thing I love about the Bible and the Gospels in particular, the story of Messiah coming into this world and establishing God's kingdom, it never hides from the pain. The gospel narratives, the entire Bible narrative, never hides from the reality of pain. It doesn't present some triumphalist ideal where in every situation the good guys always seem to win or something like that. No, it clearly presents suffering to us in all of its ugliness. But it also reveals that it's the very stuff that God's working through to bring about his purposes and the ultimate good, the new world we're talking about, the good that we're putting our hope in. Nothing represents the idea of the seeming incongruity of suffering and triumph more than the cross. Nothing exemplifies it better than the cross experience that Jesus went through. We're going to be reading about the first stages of that experience today, and we're going to be looking at it from a particular viewpoint. Because as the drama unfolds in this section, there's one disciple who appears over and over again in this. It's like there are four acts that we're going to look at in this drama. And Peter, the Apostle Peter, appears in each one of these acts. And it's almost as though we're following these events from Peter's perspective. We're tied to Peter through this whole thing. And, you know, the moment of crisis breaks over these disciples like a wave, and the crisis shakes the faith of these disciples right to the breaking point. And as we look at Peter's example, as we look at some of the things that he does, some of the things that he says, we can actually learn something, albeit from a negative perspective, in that there are things that Peter is going to say and do that we can look at and learn from because he did that first, and we can potentially avoid doing those same things in moments when our faith is failing. Peter's awesome. I love Peter. Peter, to me, is like I'm so glad he's in these stories because he's sort of an everyman disciple. I mean, you know, we say all the time that none of us does this following Jesus thing well. None of us does this Christian thing well. And Peter represents us faltering, flailing disciples very nicely. When we look at Peter, we got an ally in there, because someone who you know, knows what it's like to screw this thing up, and yet also knows what it's like to experience the grace of God in the midst of us. His behavior and his words are going to reveal some foibles that all of us are prone to. But by looking at Peter act this out for us, we actually can gain some advice. We can advise ourselves. We can hear the voice of the Spirit advising us and guiding us. So if you're there in Matthew 26, we're going to pick up where we left off, starting with verse 31. It says, on the way where? Well, they've left the upper room where they were celebrating the Passover meal, and they're on their way to the Garden of Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives. On the way, Jesus told them, "Tonight, all of you will desert me. For the scriptures say, God will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I've been raised from the dead, I'll go ahead of you to Galilee and meet you there." Peter declared, "Even if everyone else deserts you, I'll never desert you." Jesus replied, "I tell you the truth, Peter. This very night, before the rooster crows, you'll deny three times that you even know me." "No," Peter insisted. "Even if I have to die with you, I will never deny you." And all the other disciples vowed the same. Okay, we'll stop there. So they're on their way. They're walking in the cool night air. It's been a troubling night all the way around. I mean, Jesus has been, you know, monkeying with the Passover and saying things that just seem really dour. And, you know, somebody's going to betray them in the whole thing. And then all of a sudden he just drops another bomb. "And by the way, all of you guys are going to bail out on me and leave me." Boom. You know, you can imagine what they're going through, how that is going to affect them. Even though in the midst of all of this, he is clearly defining what's going to happen as he's been up to this point. He says, you know, "You're all going to bail. It's going to be a mess. But, you know, when I'm raised from the dead, I'll meet you back in Galilee." Obviously, all of that, just they missed all of that. Yeah, whatever. Here's the thing. And, you know, we look at Peter. He's so bold. You know, he's just brashly making these promises of fidelity. We'll see how that turns out as this story goes on. He's so bold, but he's boldly mistaken. And so if we're looking at his example and learning from his mistakes, in those times of trouble, in difficulty, when our faith is falling apart, it's important for us to resist a temptation to be overconfident in our own strength. Because that's exactly what's happening here with Peter. This is something that we're all prone to in those times, especially in those times when there's no immediate danger. You know, when you're walking along in the cool night air with the rabbi and everything's just fine, when there's no immediate threat, it's very easy to start thinking, you know, I'm pretty mature as a Christian. I think I got this thing down. I think I know what I'm doing now. And you know, we start thinking about how strong our faith is, how far we've come. And there's nothing wrong with being happy about how we've progressed or matured as followers, but man, if we start looking at ourselves, thinking about how capable we are at overcoming difficulties, it can be a danger for us, just like it was for Peter, to start developing an overconfidence in our own abilities, in our own strength to overcome life's problems. Because we can see right here in the text, there's a problem in Peter's response to Jesus. When Jesus warns that they're all going to stumble and flee, Peter, I love how Pete right away throws everybody else out of the bus. You know, even if these losers, I look at them and I can see what you're talking about, Jesus. But I'm not going to, it's not going to happen to me. He says, I won't, over and over again. His emphasis is on himself. His emphasis is right here on what I can do. I'm too good for that. I'm too strong. And I have no doubt that Peter was a strong dude. He's, you know, I don't doubt that. But human strength is not enough when faced with a broken world like we live in. Human strength is not enough to maintain our faith and keep us connected. This is a danger for all of us, to begin trusting in our own powers and abilities to bring us through times of trouble. In 1 Corinthians 10:12, Paul warns us, the Apostle Paul says, "Let those who think they stand take heed, lest they fall." You know, that he's basically saying the same thing in this. An attitude can easily creep into our mindset that, you know, where we're so confident in our abilities. Maybe we've had several years of this following Jesus thing going on in our lives. And so we feel pretty good about where we are. And maybe even it begins to shift our focus to, you know, our neighbor's walk, you know, looking at them a little bit askance, looking around at the defects of others and assuming that our faith is a little bit better than their faith in this whole thing, just like Peter did here. Because he immediately contrasts what he considers to be his own superior place of strength with the clear defects in the other disciples, the weaknesses in the other ones. And that's just a danger for all of us. If we think we're standing strong, if we think we finally got this together, if we think we've, you know, got this thing down, we need to pay attention to our own life of faith, because it could just so easily be shaken. Remember, our calling as followers of Jesus, and you got to hear what I'm saying in this. Don't mistake what I'm saying. But as followers of Christ, we're not called to mature into super Christians who no longer need God anymore. You know, people who've got it together and we always have the right answer and we always overcome in every situation because, you know, we just do this thing now. No. I mean, in the crazy church, I labored under that kind of notion a lot. We had this whole thing that we're going to be sanctified into overcomers who, you know, obviously have all the faith in the world and all the miracles and everything like that. Bold, mature Christians. We always got it together. But not only is that not realistic, but it's not what the Bible has actually called us to. It's not what Scripture calls us to. Certainly, it calls us to mature as we go along, to in this state of redemption by God, to allow the Holy Spirit to reshape us so our values begin to come into line with what it is that God intended for us from the beginning. But the notion of a good Christian who always has it all together is a mythological creature. It's nothing to compare ourselves with. It's nothing to be afraid of. You know, people won't go to church because all the good Christians are there. Well, they're not at Eastgate, because I know a lot of them. So. But we are redeemed, and we are being reshaped, as we move along. But we are still dealing with a fallen flesh, and we live in a fallen world that is something we have to contend with on a daily basis. And some days we're going to do well, and some days we won't do well, but it's God's grace that makes the difference. So we need to resist an overconfidence in our own abilities to be able to hold fast to this. So our own strength, our hope, our strength is found in Christ, in trusting in His grace to always hold fast to us, in trusting in His grace to bring us through, in His power to hold on to us and never let us go. All right, the narrative goes on. Verse 36. Then Jesus went with them to the olive grove called Gethsemane, and He said, "Sit here while I go over there to pray." I don't know why, that just seems kind of almost demeaning. You sit here, I'm going over there to pray. Either way, and I'm sure it wasn't like that, it just reads that way to me. He took Peter and Zebedee's two sons, James and John, and he became anguished and distressed, and he told them, "My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." And he went on a little farther and bowed with his face to the ground, praying, "My Father, if it's possible, let this cup of suffering be taken away from me. Yet I want your will to be done, not mine." Then he returned to the disciples and he found them asleep. And he said to Peter, couldn't you watch with me even 1 hour? Keep watch and pray so that you'll not give in to temptation. For the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Then Jesus left them a second time and prayed, my Father, if this cup cannot be taken away unless I drink it, your will be done. When he returned to them again, he found them sleeping, for they couldn't keep their eyes open. So he went to pray a third time, saying the same things again. Then he came to the disciples and said, go ahead and sleep. Have your rest. But look, the time has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Up, let's be going. Look, my betrayer is here. Okay, so Jesus is facing this agonizing moment. The cross is in full view for him now. He knows what it is that's about to happen. He knows what this is going to cost him. And he knows that the way through this agony, not out of this, but through this agony, is by communicating with the Father. The disciples, on the other hand, feel like they could handle everything better with just a quick nap, which I relate to a lot. Jesus confronts, though, what is essentially escapism in their experiences. And, of course, he singles Peter out. I love that. The other disciples are sleeping, too. But it's Peter who he gets his attention. And he says to Peter, napping, you know, napping is not going to provide you the ability to stand strong. Communicating with the Father will. Communicating with God. And again, so we look at this. We look at these events. We look at, again, Peter and some of the things that he's doing, and we learn from this. We can learn even from his mistakes that when our faith is falling apart, we never want to underestimate the importance of prayer, how powerfully important it is in our lives. Communication with God, something that the disciples were not doing in this moment of crisis. And, you know, it's not as though it wasn't a crisis for Jesus. Obviously, it was. He's about to take the guilt of the world onto himself in his sacrificial death. And he's crying out to his Father, if there's some other way, could we do that? If there's some other way to go about this, however, I'm going to yield. I'll yield to your purposes and your will. Of course, there wasn't. And Jesus, you know, in humility, does submit to that. But when he goes back to his close disciples, he doesn't find them, you know, wrestling in prayer as much as he finds them snoring. And we can understand that, though. I mean, honestly, let's step away from we've obviously got our theological mindsets on, and you know, we're very familiar with these stories. You don't have to put your hands up, but I mean, surely we're all familiar with this, most of us here. And so it's easy to kind of make assumptions about this, but really, let's step into their shoes for just a minute. Try this on. Think about what it was like for them in this. I mean, it's been a sorrowful night. I don't know about you. You know, when I start getting bummed out or whatever, a nap seems great to me. There's nothing better than a pity nap. I love those. Those are awesome. So, I mean, it's been a bummer of a night. He's been saying all these things. It just seems like the band's breaking up. We don't know what's going on. Not only that, they just had a full meal. And in the Passover meal, there are multiple cups of wine going on in that. So you can just imagine, it's late at night, they're sad, they're full, they've had the wine, and so they start to nod off. It's hard to keep the eyes open. We totally can understand that. I mean, I hope I'm not the only one who, you know, something's really bothering me, I set off to get into some serious prayer and, you know, wake up with drool down my face a little bit later on. I'm like, yeah, sorry about that. But, you know, we get this. But even though we get it, we're still called to a different response. You know, we can get it. We can relate to it. This is very human. But there's still something deeper in us that God is trying to draw out of us. We're called to a different response. Jesus says the spirit is willing. Our inner person, redeemed, re-energized by God's spirit, has the want to. But our bodies want a nap. I mean, that's just the reality. Those are the struggles that we go through in this. And that's especially true in these times of pain or sorrow or difficulty. It's hard to pray in those times. And here's the thing, and I know I know by making statements, this is what I know, that by making statements that encourage us to pray, I run the risk of making everybody in here feel worse. Like, you know, yeah, I know I should be praying. We can start feeling bad because we don't pray enough. I know I don't pray enough, and thanks for reminding me. And I know that I've been through this a lot in the past, and hearing people preach on this subject, and sometimes you just want to crawl out of the place because you're just like, you know, I'll never do this right. I'll never get this right. But here's the thing. I wonder if sometimes prayer becomes such a difficulty at those times because of what we make prayer out to be. And I think that plays a lot in this. I mean, sometimes I think we avoid praying because we've got a flawed view of what constitutes prayer, of what it actually means to be praying. I think years of traditional church culture has played its part in partitioning prayer off into a section of life that, you know, I hope I get around to at some point. A sectionalized portion of our life that, you know, is completely discordant with our normal everyday life. And oftentimes, prayer becomes this sort of spiritual production on our part. I'm not, you know, I'm just saying that these things happen to us, as though, you know, it's about having the right solemnity on our face and the proper inflection in the voice, you know, as though somehow we're going to put on a really good performance for God and, you know, he'll hear it at that point. And listen, we can have the best of intentions and fall into this. We'll meet and pray before the meetings here on Sunday mornings. Oftentimes, several of us gather together. Anybody's welcome to do that around 8:30 if you want to. And I noticed one time that, you know, we're talking and the group that's there, we're talking and laughing and, you know, whatever. And then somebody says, all right, we need to pray. And all of a sudden, you know, it comes down like this. And I even had to say that in the prayer. I just said, Lord, you know, I don't know what you think about that, that it seems like we quit having fun when we talk to you. I don't know how I would feel about that. But see, that's the thing, that we turn it into this performance that we have to do. Like, if God can hear the right words strung together with the right mix of emotion and reverence in the voice, he's like, oh, that's a good one. Yeah, I'll take that. I'll listen to that one. What do they want? What is it they want? I may not do that, but still, I like that prayer. No, prayer is communicating. This is what prayer is. It is communicating with God like one would communicate with a friend or one would communicate with a loved one. It's just communicating. Yeah, but you know, Rob, I still have trouble with that because, you know, I just don't feel like I communicate with God very well. I don't feel like I do it very often or anything. Well, how about this? Do you think about God during the course of the day? As you're going about life, as we're doing our daily things, do we think about God at all? Well, you know, sure, but not in any kind of real spiritual way. I'm usually trying to figure out what a good Christian would do in a situation like this, or where is God in that situation. But you know what? Cool. That's good. Because that's communication right there. That's, you know, our we need to realize that our thoughts are not bottled up in our head, in our own mind. We belong to God. God hears our thoughts. He listens to us as his children. And we might go, oh, no. But I mean, but that's the reality of it. It's not like there's this prayer valve or something that we turn on and off and, you know, we got that one through finally. You know, it's not as though God's waiting for the right word. I just got to start with our Father and end with in Jesus' name. Okay, works. Okay, we flip the switch and the prayer goes up, but the rest of the stuff is all trapped in here. No, we have God's ear because we're his children. He's always hearing those thoughts. That is prayer. That's communication. Those thoughts we have about God during the course of a day, they're the vehicle of communication with him. No matter where we are, no matter what we're doing, no matter what's going on all around us. If we're casting our thoughts towards him, thinking about him, that's he's listening. We've got his ears. So start with that concept and allow the Holy Spirit to begin to refine that and open up patterns of communication with God all the time so that we can even fulfill what Paul talks about, pray without ceasing. And I know he's saying just don't give up on prayer, but I mean, still throughout the day, we can be praying as our thoughts are heading towards God without this pressure of performance associated with it. Yeah, but, you know, Rob, sometimes my thoughts about God are not always that nice. Sometimes I'm frustrated. You know, sometimes I'm mad. Great. That's even better. Honestly, I could say that's the best stuff right there because it's real. Because at that moment, we're being honest. We're being real with a creator God. We're acknowledging that there is a God, and we're being honest with this creator God about where we are in life. Martin Luther once challenged his students, saying, "Have you ever dared to be angry with God, believing enough in his grace that we can be real and honest with him?" If our faith is falling apart, honesty is the only thing that's going to secure it. Honesty with God is never wrong, never wrong. Jesus himself in this passage is arguing with the Father in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's saying, if there's some other way, I'd like to do that. It's not that he's going to kick against it and disobey, but he's honest about where he is in his own humanness and desire to preserve himself. If we're afraid to be honest with God as though somehow we're going to offend him or get on his bad side, I don't know what we're going to do with the Psalms. We're going to have to just tear those out of our Bible altogether because it's filled with complaints and demands on God to be God. You're a creator God. Now be creator God for me in my life, in this situation. I'm worn out calling for help. My throat is parched. My eyes fail looking for God. Why, O Lord, you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? And on and on and on and on. If God's going to be offended, well, he would have kicked that part out of the Bible altogether. Don't let him say that kind of stuff to me. Prayer is not some sort of pious, fake humility that crafts just the right, you know, inoffensive phrases as though we're making a pitch to God and getting on his good side. The prayer of faith discloses the heart in all honesty, believing that God is big enough to take it if we might be mad, loving enough to understand it if we're frustrated, and strong enough to work in our pain towards something good, towards that new world that starts in our own lives, in our own hearts. Okay, well, moving along, verse 47. And even as Jesus said this, Judas, one of the 12 disciples, arrived with a crowd of men armed with swords and clubs. They had been sent by the leading priests and elders of the people. The traitor, Judas, had given them a prearranged signal. You'll know which one to arrest when I greet him with a kiss. So Judas came straight to Jesus. "Greetings, Rabbi," he exclaimed and gave him a kiss. Jesus said, "My friend, go ahead and do what you've come for." The others grabbed Jesus and arrested him, but one of the men with Jesus pulled out his sword and struck the high priest's slave, slashing off his ear. "Put away your sword," Jesus told him. "Those who use the sword will die by the sword. Don't you realize I could ask my Father for thousands of angels to protect us, and he'd send them instantly? But if I did, how would the scriptures be fulfilled that describe what must happen now?" Then Jesus said to the crowd, "Am I some dangerous revolutionary that you come with swords and clubs to arrest me? Why didn't you arrest me at the temple? I was there teaching every day." But this is all happening to fulfill the words of the prophets as recorded in the scriptures. And at that point, all the disciples deserted him and fled. Okay, so suddenly this still night is broken by the sounds of feet marching in and the sounds of voices and the smell of torch smoke hanging in the air, and a gang of men with clubs and swords invade the space. The fact that they're swords indicates to us that more than likely there are Roman soldiers in the mix, because the temple guards wouldn't have carried swords. Judas is clearly revealed as the betrayer, and they grab Jesus to arrest him. And it says in verse 51 that one of the disciples pulls his sword and attacks in defense of Jesus. And in John's gospel, that samurai disciple is identified as who?
Peter.
Of course it's Peter. He's been overconfident in his own strength. He's been asleep instead of communicating with the Father. So he's not aware that this is the time to surrender and not the time to fight. And so, again, if we're going to learn from Peter's mistakes, then when our faith is falling apart in those difficult and troublesome times in our lives, we have to resist the urge to fix things through fleshly zeal. We've got to be careful about not just taking off and doing something. We're challenged to surrender our zeal to God. Peter evaluates the situation, and his evaluation is correct. This is unfair, what they're doing here. This is not right at all. Jesus hasn't done anything wrong, and what's happening here is a miscarriage of justice. This is all wrong. So he impulsively acts on his own evaluation, probably gives out a war cry as he takes off, and ends up creating a whole new situation that Jesus then has to clean up. The other gospel accounts tell us that he actually has to heal the guy's ear that gets cut off in the melee. Jesus tells Peter, I've already gone over this with my father. I've already covered this area. If this was a time to fight, well, I mean, he would have sent, you know, a heavenly SEAL team down here to just clear the field. It would have been done. But this is a time for surrender in order to fulfill God's bigger plans. And he reinforces, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. You know, partly revealing that the kingdom of God is going to advance differently than the kingdoms of this world. It's not going to be advancing or making its way through force or coercion or the threat of violence. But he's also pointing out that uncontrolled zeal like this can be very problematic. You take off, run out there to do something like this, and you could even get yourself in trouble in this. So often when our faith is starting to fall apart, we think that if we can just stir something up, by getting all excited about, you know, whatever it is, an issue, or just whip up some emotional furor over something, we're going to have a reconnect somewhere along the way. And look, it's great to have a zeal for God. We want to be zealous for him, to be passionate for his kingdom. But we have to have that zeal surrendered to God's guidance and God's values. What it is that his values and his priorities are. Peter had a zealous loyalty for Jesus. He did. I think he truly wanted to do something good. He was out trying to defend Jesus, which is a whole other subject in and of itself. But without surrendering that zeal to God's bigger picture, to God's values, he actually ends up working against God's purposes in this thing. By letting that zeal run unchecked and unsubmitted to God's bigger picture, to God's values. Instead of trying to whip up some fleshly zeal, we need to surrender to God's purposes, to learn what his values are, so that those values can then guide us into how it is that we respond, react, what it is that's going to reignite our faith, not just our emotional whirlwind that we can create. But that deeper passion, I look at the difference between that emotional, fleshly kind of zeal and passion. You know, a fleshly kind of zeal is like the waves during a storm that just whip up, you know, and there's all white caps and all this activity. But zeal is that strong current way underneath. It's not affected by all of this, but it just keeps going. It just keeps moving along obedience in the same direction. All right, well, finishing up this morning, you're like, whew, okay, yeah, but we got a few verses to go. So let's read the rest of the chapter, verse 57. Then the people who had arrested Jesus led him to the home of Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of religious law and the elders had gathered. Meanwhile, Peter followed him at a distance and came to the high priest's courtyard. He went in and sat with the guards and waited to see how it would all end. Inside, the leading priests and the entire high council were trying to find witnesses who would lie about Jesus so that they could put him to death. But even though they found many who agreed to give false witness, they couldn't use anyone's testimony. In other words, they weren't lining up with each other. Finally, two men came forward who declared, "This man said, 'I'm able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Well, aren't you going to answer these charges? What do you have to say for yourself?" But Jesus remained silent. Then the high priest said to him, "I demand in the name of the living God, tell us if you're the Messiah, the Son of God." Jesus replied, "You've said it. And in the future, you will see the Son of Man seated in the place of power at God's right hand and coming in the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothing to show his horror and said, "Blasphemy! Why do we need other witnesses? You've all heard this blasphemy. What's your verdict?" "Guilty," they shouted. "He deserves to die." And they began to spit in Jesus' face and beat him with their fists. Some slapped him, jeering, "Prophesy to us, you Messiah. Who hit you that time?" Meanwhile, Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard. A servant girl came over and said to him, "You were one of those with Jesus, the Galilean." But Peter denied it in front of everyone. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. Later, out by the gate, another servant girl noticed him and said to those standing around, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." Again, Peter denied it, this time with an oath. Oops, did I go too far? This time with an oath. "I don't even know the man," he said. A little later, some of the other bystanders came over to Peter and said, "You must be one of them. We can tell by your Galilean accent." Peter swore, "A curse on me if I'm lying. I don't know the man." And immediately, the rooster crowed. Suddenly, Jesus' words flashed through Peter's mind. "Before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times that you even know me." And he went away, weeping bitterly. And that's where we'll stop today. You know, everything about this trial that Jesus is going through based on the laws of the Sanhedrin at that time was illegal. According to the laws of Israel, the trial was not supposed to be held during the holy days, Passover being a holy day. You couldn't do a trial then. It was never supposed to be conducted at night. Trials were always supposed to happen during the day. If you had witnesses that weren't in agreement, then it was supposed to be held differently. The whole thing. It was supposed to be out in public. The whole thing was just off. And we've said before that the temple leadership was so convinced about their rightness and their position with God that violating their own laws didn't seem to be that big of a deal as long as they got to do what it is that they wanted to do. What's interesting is Peter's part in this story and the dramatic way that we come full circle from where we began to the sound of this rooster crowing, just as Jesus had predicted it at the outset, as Peter is denying that he even knows Jesus. In verse 58, it says that Peter was following at a distance. And, at first, obviously, he ran like everybody else did in the garden there. But then, obviously, he tries to stay on the periphery of this event, just out of reach a little bit. And then when people try to identify him as a follower of Jesus, he outright denies even knowing Jesus three times in this. And a lot has been taught about this event. There's tons and tons of teachings out there. I'm glad that it's not the end of Peter's story. I'm glad it doesn't end right there with him weeping bitterly. In John's gospel, after the resurrection, Jesus restores Peter and he actually commissions him to take care of the church. But here, at this point, we again notice a mistake that he makes, something that we can learn from, to seek God's help and ability to avoid in our own experiences. And that's when our faith is falling apart. In those times of difficulty, we need to resist the temptation to dissociate from Jesus, to make this break from him. Peter was trying to follow at a safe distance, wanting to see how this is all going to pan out, what all is going to happen here. And when our faith is falling apart, when times are difficult, that is not the time to turn fatalistic and start backing away from any belief that Jesus is able to redeem the situation. Because clearly, Peter did not believe that Jesus was going to be able to redeem this. This was spiraling out of control, and he didn't see any hope in being close to Jesus. You know, things start going badly. Sometimes they happen in succession. Have you ever been going through a time in life where like one thing goes bad and then all of a sudden, boom, another and then another. And it just feels like it snowballs after a while. And sometimes it can just, you just feel numb inside. You just feel like, whatever, you know, I don't even know. I just want to bail out of this. I don't even want to have to try to figure any of this out. I'm just going to quit following or thinking about any of this. I'll just kind of drift away. Maybe just glance over from a distance at what's going on here. And listen, as a pastor, I've seen this happen way more times than I want to remember. Somebody disappears from meeting with us. And it's not as though meeting with us is the end-all, be-all of this experience. But this is a place where we refocus. It's a place where there's community, and we live this out in community. So someone disappears, and so I'll reach out, and I hear things like, you know, I'm just going through some stuff right now. I'll get back to my faith when I work this stuff out. I just can't think about it right now. And I'll tell you, that is the last thing we want to do. I mean, I warn people all the time that if we think, well, I'm going to just get this stuff together and then I'll come back, we'll never come back because we will not get this stuff together. We don't have the capacity to get this right in ourselves. To bail out and to drift away from Jesus is to drift away from the only one who can actually start to bring stability into our lives, into our thoughts, into our coping mechanisms. Sometimes, like in Peter's case, we feel like following Jesus is the reason that we've got so much trouble in our lives. It wouldn't have been so bad. You know, I used to live my life and everything was just going fine. I wouldn't be in this mess if it weren't for the fact that I'm trying to please God in these whole situations. So it seems like the solution is to back away from Christ or to back away from his claims on our life, to just get a little bit of normalcy. I just want a normal life again. But we have to remember that when we start thinking thoughts like that, and, you know, we think those thoughts. I mean, if we're going to be honest about it, those thoughts come to our minds. We have to remember we've actually got an enemy at work. Something we don't think about maybe as often as we should. Not that we want to obsess over an enemy lurking out there in some unseen capacity, but that's a reality of our experience. You know, if we start thinking, you know, maybe I just need to break from this Christianity and church thing, we need to realize God is not suggesting that thought to us. Our redeemed inner person is not coming to that conclusion. Hey, that's a great idea. I think that's a good idea. No. There's only one other voice left. There's only one other influence there that's suggesting to that. It's suggesting that to us. Let's not listen to that. Let's not listen to that suggestion. Let's move and, you know, resist the enemy and he'll flee from you. What does it mean to resist? If somebody's pulling me this way, I'm going to go the opposite direction. Let's keep close with the only one who's going to be able to redeem this stuff in our lives. Because he loves us. Because he cares about us. Cast your care on the Lord because he cares for you. That's an important thing to remember. He cares about us. He cares about what happens to us. Even though it's hard for us to see. Even though, like the disciples that night, we just can't imagine how this could ever work out into something okay even, much less good. We have to believe and trust. God does care, and he is working all things together for the good of those who love him. So, learning from Peter's miscues, when our faith is falling apart, we want to resist being overconfident in our own strength. We want to press on in prayer. Let's submit our zeal to God. And above all, let's stick close to Jesus as we live out this life. Those are steps we can take towards a stable life. And a stable life is a life that points the way towards a brand new world. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please?